Hello, everybody. Welcome to Art Talk. I'm Chris Busey, your host, talking with artists, performers, and writers about what moves them. Today is our second conversation with the poet and publisher Peter Money, who was here last week to talk about the Harbor Mountain Press, the harbor being Provincetown, the mountain being Vermont, the kinds of books he publishes. He read something of his own poetry. But we were talking about his origins in some of his influential teachers that got him started in his present career. And one key figure was Allen Ginsberg. And we were speaking about Ginsberg's concept of the ego, which unlike many of the Zen practitioners that he was friendly with and went in the same circles, he had an actual idea that reminds me of Norman Mailer's need for the writer to have a rock solid ego, you know, like a fortress that protects him. It's a different idea than being a pillow. And so is not the search to become a poet a search for the self? And is not the search for the self the search for a persona, that is the person who will write the poems?
Yeah, I think though the poet has to do so while also observing the self. So as you build the self, you observe the self's inadequacies. And I say that thinking of Jeffers' quote, "The poet builds his tower mockingly."
There is some irony in it. Again, the quotable Norman Mailer said, when you're young, you start wearing a hat. As you get older, you become the hat. Hmm. You absorb your pretense, mm-hmm. and it becomes you. But there is an element of initially pretending until you pretend so hard that you believe. I mean, I think this is why adolescents go through such hell and high water, because their belief system is not strong. They would like to be this way. They would like to be that way, but they haven't proven over time the self they are. But as you get older, you look back and say, I made this decision, that decision, this decision, this decision. I am this person, because you're the history of your experience now, and you have experience, you know. I say, and this is another puzzling thing because of the wisdom factor in developing a literary mind, as opposed to the way a musical genius can be pre-puberty and do work of genius, almost bypassing the conscious mind. But words, you have to acquire language. You got to get facile and know the history of words, know the meaning, know the emotional ring of them.
I think we come to music first. We come to our mother's rhythm. We come to heartbeat. We come to breath first. So I'm not surprised that there are musical geniuses who show themselves through music first.
Yeah, I agree. And the word that I've learned to talk about this phenomenon is periodicity, the recurrence that happens in our daily lives and stuff, and the puzzle between what is an eternal recurrence and what is a historical instance, and how our memory operates on certain times that stay with us as if they have never past, you know, the memories are still vivid. I think trauma is what creates these memories, and I think it does it in a very specific psychological way. I've thought quite a bit about this in the last few years. When a person undergoes a severe trauma, a life-threatening trauma, let's say, or some kind of a violent act against themselves, against them, their mind remembers the instance without a context, because everything has become very narrow. And so that the recovery process requires gaining context for the circumstances that surrounded the moment of trauma. And I do think that that entails a kind of life purpose, mm-hmm. a mission. Like someone murdered your mother and you're going to start murdering murderers, or maybe you're going to start a foundation for families of that had their mothers murdered.
Victims.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in other words, what is your life mission after an instance of terror? Because that gets folded into the way you recover the memory.
And I think...
And don't you think poetry does something like that? That there's always some key nodal point, the licking of the wounds.
Absolutely. Howard Zinn talks about poets providing the emotion that...
Historians leave out.
That historians leave out, that that prose even tends to leave out, which is why I wanted my prose to be infused with and by the poetic, which is primarily sensual, sensory-based, and therefore emotionally-based, and greatly based in rhythm, that elemental sense of tide, that sense of mother, that sense of breath, that sense of heartbeat.
Day and night.
Day and night. I think of Ginsberg, too, writing through trauma. And some of the other poets who have come to mean a lot to me, like Sadi Youssef and Sinan Antun, who write about war. From Iraq.
Iraq.
And Ginsberg wrote through, not through a mugging, but of course he was probably conscious of a kind of composition, poetic composition, through his mugging experience. And so there's a gestalt in that, but there's...
For our listeners, and even for my edification, can you elaborate a little on the mugging incident? I'm not sure I know about it.
Yeah, I won't be able to quote from the poem, but he did write a poem about having been mugged, but he takes the reader through it, step by step.
From the point of view of the mugger or the victim?
From the victim's point of view, it's not without compassion to the perpetrator. You know, others have done this. Joan Larkin, who sometimes in Provincetown has also written from an autobiographical experience of trauma, hers with alcoholism. So, yeah, the poem will do that, and I think the poem helps us do that. I say the poem, and I mean, you know, sort of the universal poem, but poems specifically allow us to take that breath at the end of a line, to put together juxtapositions for the subconscious.
That might be, you hit on something there that strikes me as fresh. To offer suggestions to the subconscious, is that the way you phrased it? To offer...
Exactly. I think poetry provides layers that prose cannot necessarily provide.
See, that is interesting to me because I've always felt that a good poem was like a hypnotic induction. In Xanadu did Kubla Khan, a stately pleasure dome decree, and suddenly you're going down the rabbit hole. You know, it's like your arms are getting very heavy, your eyes are becoming leaden. You're beginning to think back on this experience. And then suddenly you go into a once upon a time mode, and it's delightful as a children's squeal of joy, you know, that kind of natural experience of allowing the imagination to take you on a surprising journey. And I mean, a poet has to train themselves to function. I mean, your job is to think creatively all day long. You know, and to be mindful of anything. And does that mean you're only working when you're sitting in your desk? Absolutely not. The meter is ticking constantly. And can you speak about, you know, how a writer actually works?
Well, that's why Provincetown is such fertile ground for me, because so much intersects in one place. It's not only the characters who are also engaged in this work. You know, it's not only being able to speak with Michael Cunningham for a moment on the beach because he's also beachcombing. By the way, we share Brooklyn College.
Oh. He went to Brooklyn College?
He was leading the program there for a while.
Oh.
He probably doesn't remember, but anyway, this is not an uncommon experience in Provincetown to have encounters with others who are engaged in observation or engaged in relief from the otherwise daily, the other world daily. But the fact of tides, the fact of beachcombing, the fact of a very visibly changing landscape and seascape, you know, all of it is an exercise in attention. But it's also a place here where I feel I really can kind of clear the slate and let the poetic enter a little bit more than at home in Vermont, because at home in Vermont or at anyone's home, you know, we all have jobs to do. I also teach, and we all, you know, have to fix the car and get to the mechanic, et cetera. And having time in Provincetown allows for the empty page.
Yeah. It's, there's also the rich tradition here. To give you an example of how you're fostering that, just think of the way you named your son Hartley after the painter Marston Hartley, who had Provincetown roots, was in, you know, the Northwest up in Vermont and Maine. You've absorbed his culture. And just to let our audience know that Marston Hartley was, his estate was fostered by Hudson Walker, who one of the founders of the Fine Arts Work Center. And now after Hudson's death, some of the paintings were used to develop the work center, but over 100 paintings went to the University of Minnesota, where there's this great collection of Hartleys. And so and when you think back that someone like Hudson is in our mythological memory, and we have this bond because we have these memories, and our children get remembered through their memories and stuff. So, you know, you're deeply part of the Provincetown culture, and that's why I'm happy that you're on the program here and people are getting to know you a little. How would people seek you out on the web, Harbor Mountains Press, for example?
Well, petermoney.com has links to my Twitter account, my blog, and Harbor Mountain Press.
Mm-hmm. Now, speak about your blog and how you, do you often do that, like, I mean, do you do that on a daily basis, a weekly basis? How often do you add a section?
Oh, it's probably a monthly or bi-monthly practice in the essay. I use Twitter more as a kind of daily journal, as well as a handwritten journal.
And a lot of your blog entries deal with quotations or commentary on observations that sparked a kind of connection with you. I mean, you quoted E.L. Doctorow in one I read this morning. What was it about?
It's a kind of riffing I think I like to do, and it's a sort of studio space.
Studio space. This is Art Talk. We have to close down. My friend Peter Money, who we've been talking to, we ask you to check out his blog and join us next week for another session of Art Talk. Peter, thanks very much.
Thanks, Chris.